Welcome to Methods, a podcast from the ESRC National Centre for Research Methods at the University of Southampton. In today's episode, Dr. Jonathan Minton from the University of Glasgow talks about using data visualisation to look at important social trends.
The reason to visualise data is it plays to people's strengths. It plays to an inherently human set of strengths about what people are good at compared with what people aren't good at. And the way I've tried to explain this a few times before is through the Looking Glass by Lewis Carroll. There's this statement where the White Queen is trying to undermine Alice and says, "Can you do addition? What's one and 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 one?" And Alice says, I don't know, I've lost count. So there are ways of presenting information that really play to people's weaknesses, and that's when you're just kind of given this list of pieces of information in just a sequence, and you can very quickly get overloaded with information when it's presented that way. Whereas if you're presented exactly the same amount of information or even orders of magnitude more information, but in a way that's intuitive to people, then suddenly it makes sense. Suddenly very small, very low cognitive barriers of working memory of just four, five or six or so pieces that you can think about and handle at one time, you can get completely past that because you've got just an image.
And how does this help us?
Once you see all of this data kind of holistically together, you can identify patterns in it a lot more easily than any machine can. So machines are very good at doing these symbolically complex things, so they can add thousands of numbers many times a second without ever making a mistake, but they struggle to see a picture of an apple and say that's actually an apple, and they struggle to think in a gestalt way, to think about lots of things in totality and to make sense of them. The reason to visualize data and to think quite carefully about how you represent data visually is to play to people's strengths rather than their weaknesses.
So you've been using something called a Lexis surface. Can you explain what that is and where the idea comes from?
Basically, you take concepts that have been used to represent variations in height or something else over space, and you apply it to time instead. So instead of having latitude, you have relative age, i.e. the age since an event, and usually that event is when people were born. And across that other axis, you've got absolute time, i.e. year in most cases. So you've got year across one axis, you've got age across the other, and each of those combinations of age and year, you've got a different risk or propensity or quantity of something. Now, whether that's a population size, whether it's a fertility risk, whether it's a propensity to migrate, or it's a risk of dying within that next year or so.
You've described this as looking a bit like a sort of a topographical map. Is that right? Is that a good way to visualize?
Yes. So just with a topographical map, you use various tricks and conventions to represent something that's inherently three-dimensional on a page, because of course any page is fundamentally just a two-dimensional image. Within a topographical map, you typically use something like contour lines, isolines, and the idea of isolines being that they connect points across this surface that have equal value, so equal height. And you can use propensity to recognize patterns, to look at groups of isolines to recognize where hills, valleys, and other kind of geographic features are and how they vary over a surface. And then you can support that information from the contour lines with additional visual cues such as shading, colours, and so on.
So how can this method be used then to understand some of the important social issues that are facing us all today, which are the sorts of things that you use it for?
It can be incredibly effective at showing where we are today in a much, much longer term context, because populations, deaths, marriages and so on, these are data that have been recorded pretty consistently in lots of different countries for in some cases over a quarter of a millennia. So for some countries, I think like Norway, for instance, and Sweden, you can go back hundreds of years and just get this real sense of how what's typical and what's expected and what's normal today is a very different set of life experiences to how it used to be 2, 3 or more generations ago. And so you can see how, for instance, a number of the problems or challenges of today, in particular those to do with declining fertility, increasing longevity, increasing population aging, are really problems that come out of the amazing positive changes that have happened over the last few generations.
Let's start then to sort of narrow down into some of the questions that you have used it to look at. And let's start with mortality. You mentioned that a moment ago. What are the key things being to emerge there in terms of what you've found?
There's something known as the bathtub curve, a way of describing how the relationship between age and mortality risk varies. So in the first year of life, there has historically been, and there continues to be, a very high mortality risk. And then as soon as you get past that first year, or in some cases the first 2 years, the mortality risk drops right down to the lowest levels that anyone's likely to experience. And then it shoots up again once people reach adulthood. You can see for men, once they reach around the age of 16, 17, 18, the mortality risk between around those ages up to around about the early to mid-20s is noticeably elevated, and then it falls down again. And then it seems to continue rising, and it rises log-linearly. So if you look at all of this data on a logarithmic scale, you can see this incredibly straight line from around the age of 35 onwards for both men and women. And this log-linear increase in mortality risk with age represents the mortality risk increasing exponentially with each additional age of life.
So how does that change once you put that data on Alexa's surface?
You compare the shape of this bathtub curve from, say, around 1900 to compared with around 2000, you can see that although it's got the same kind of qualitative shape, it's changed, and it's changed such that the mortality risk that people used to face maybe when they were around the age of 50, each of those mortality risk hurdles, if you like, has been pushed back, and it's been pushed back very consistently over a very long-term period. So although the shape's the same, qualitatively, it's got a lot shallower. And it's this additional shallowness that's contributed to an increasing aging population.
What are the implications of that? What does it tell us?
Well, the other thing that you get from looking at the data in this way, you can see the very rapid fall in infant mortality throughout the developed world, or most of the developed world, generally throughout most of the 20th century. It still tends to be continuing. So there's obviously something very undeniably positive about infant mortality declining at such a rate such that it's no longer a very prevalent or typical experience. At the other end, you can see an implication, for instance, about pension ages. So, of course, when pension ages in the UK were set, they were set slightly above average life expectancy. So they were set to be quite a cheap and quite a meagre promise. And through this very long-term process of improving mortality risk at pretty much all ages, they've accidentally become something that's very generous and that represents a sort of promise or a sort of expectation to spend a large fraction of your life being looked after, not having to work and so on.
And obviously a better understanding of that over time will presumably help us plan better.
Yes, so I think when you look at the data this way, you can see each of these mortality hurdles, you can see these very long-term trends, and you can get a sense of how these trends are more likely to continue, how it would be more plausible to project them forward, and which projections forward would be less plausible.
Fascinating. Now, at the Research Methods Festival, you're going to be talking about the method in the context of visualising fertility trends. Talk us through what you'll be discussing there.
I'm combining data from the Human Fertility Database with the Human Fertility Collection. And what this does is allows you to compare, I think, close to 40 countries, whereas usually I have the horizontal axis being year and the vertical axis is age. I've changed it so that the horizontal axis is birth year and the vertical axis is age. So I'm taking the same data that you can use to produce a kind of maps of age-specific fertility rates and how they vary over time, and I'm starting to use that to illustrate what they imply for cumulative fertility rates for different cohorts. So you're comparing, in some cases, 50 or more separate cohorts of women in different countries and seeing for that cohort what's the average number of babies they have by different ages. So what I'm doing is I'm adding some contour lines that show at which age each of these 50 plus cohorts, both cohorts, achieve or reach 1.3 babies per woman, 1.5, 1.8 and 2.05.
Why those particular levels?
2.05 is a very important hurdle because that's replacement fertility levels. And if a country doesn't have replacement fertility levels, then its population will eventually go into a kind of long-term decline. But before that, when combined with increasing aging, its population structure will change and it will get an increasingly aging population with more people beyond retirement age and fewer people of working age to look after and to support them economically and directly.
You've also used this method to look at probably one of the hottest topics of today, which is migration. Explain what you've been doing there.
I've taken the population size and the recorded number of deaths in each year at each age for each of the countries within Europe, within the whole of Europe. And I've used that to produce estimates of the population size you would expect in the following year of people who are 1 year older. And then I've been comparing that for the whole of Europe, you know, each of the different countries with its own record-keeping system, its own standards, and somewhat porous borders and, you know, different levels of migration. I'm comparing the expected population counts against the actual population counts, and you get this kind of heat map of population residuals.
And what does that show?
One possible interpretation is that these population residuals are giving an imprecise measure of the propensity of people at different ages to migrate, and also the porousness of Europe as a whole in terms of how many extra people of different ages are entering into the total population of Europe over time. And you can see within this, for instance, certain very large differences in the population counts from the expected or projected population counts amongst young adults after around 2002, 2003, up to around 2008, between the ages of around 18 and 25. And we know that this young adult age is the age, additionally, when people are most likely to migrate to other countries.
And you've taken an interesting look at this in relation to fertility rates as well, haven't you?
The countries that are already meeting replacement fertility rates are in less need of migration if they want to maintain stable population sizes and stable population structures than the countries that are falling furthest behind replacement fertility rates. So Germany, Austria, and Italy. Whereas, interestingly enough, Norway, the United States, and Northern Ireland are all countries that currently are achieving replacement fertility rates. You might want to feel brave and make some bold pronouncements about how much these different countries ought to be or should be expected to be welcoming of mass immigration or opposed to mass immigration based on their long-term fertility trends and the implications that has for population structure. That is, of course, if you're assuming people and politicians are particularly rational and long-term in their thinking.
You mentioned earlier also you're working on some 3D printouts of your research showing trends in this way. So it seems to be a really powerful way not just to carry out research but to share it too. What are your thoughts on that?
Currently data visualization or at least the term data visualization is in vogue at the moment, and it's used almost synonymously with infographics. And quite often the purpose of infographics is to try and just look pretty, capture attention, and that sets certain expectations about what people are wanting or expecting from a data visualization. And one thing I've heard from otherwise quite smart people is the idea that a good data visualization is something that you should be able to understand and interpret in a matter of seconds. And when I'm working with relatively complex data visualization, and one of the main challenges I have can be getting people to slow down and start to explore some of the information contained within these images, not just to skim over it, but to be engaged and to make the effort to be able to interpret and to get as much information from these things as possible.
And does working in 3D make that more appealing, more possible?
In some ways, the 3D sculptures provide that extra kind of visual, visceral, tactile engagement that then encourages people to make that extra effort to understanding the patterns and how to go about decoding some of these demographic maps. So one particular kind of complementary use of the 3D sculptures, it's not just for a generalist audience, or it's not just for public engagement. You can use it to see, for instance, quite subtle things about how the quality of the data changes over time. So historic records used to be much poorer, much more patchy than more recent demographic records. And you can see this perhaps slightly counterintuitively in that the texture of the data changes. You can actually feel the data quality improving because it becomes rougher, because when you have less good data, you have to kind of interpolate and extrapolate it more, and that creates quite a smooth surface. Whereas where you've got better quality data, you can see when the quality of the data improves or when it's slightly made up, because that affects the look and also the texture of the sculptures that it produces.
Jonathan Minton was talking to Chris Garrington about work that he'll be presenting at the Research Methods Festival in July 2016. You can find out more on the NCRM website at www.ncrm.ac.uk.